Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting live and on demand from Buffalo, New York, and today is Sunday, August 28th, 2022. It's been some 20 years since Pride had its Dynamite show, not AEW Dynamite, Pride Dynamite, with Bob Sapp and Antonio Rodrigo Nogueira, Mirko Crow Cop, Kazushi Sakuraba. It's been 20 years. But joining me is Chris Gullo and Jesse Collings. Hello.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning to everyone out there listening and watching us on YouTube.
Yes. Jesse's joining us after much demand. And I think, I don't know what time we're going to be doing this next week. We were just discussing off air. But I think Jesse's going to be with us regularly from now on, right?
Yeah, it depends on if my booking fee is met, but yes.
Mm-hmm. It depends on, I know there's been some locker room drama between you and Chris Gullo, but I've pulled you both into separate rooms, and I've reprimanded you. No suspensions are necessary yet.
Yeah, Gullo pulled me aside and said, I think you have a bright future, but I will never put you over.
He heard you talking about workers' rights and was like, you know, yeah.
He's got to squash that, you know?
Okay. So, what are we going to talk about today, Chris Gull? You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, so we're going to talk about, has the AEW-WWE momentum shifted? And we're going to kind of break that down in a few different ways. We're going to discuss ratings, AEW's current relationship with Warner Discovery. We're going to discuss live attendance, and we're going to break that down with market-to-market attendance analysis, and really also discuss what markets maybe are being neglected by AEW. As far as going there, we'll also discuss, like I said, we're going to TV rings with Google Trends, YouTube data, and we'll answer the question, what really is the draw? Is it the star? Is it the brand? Or is it something else? Well,
some of these points will be brief. Goal is doing a good job trying to summarize my erratic slides. But is there anything else you guys want to bring up as we go on? Probably should have asked you that off air, but here we are.
No, I mean, I have some points, I think, related to the what you've gathered today. I think the talking points this week are pretty clear.
Okay. So I guess we'll start with my general impression that, like, it's been, you know, we talked about this last week. We talked about this a little bit on Thursday for the audio, the like 30-minute audio that Gullo and I did for subscribers, in that my impression is that, you know, it's been more gradual. I've been careful about it over time, but I think it's only been like a little over a month now since Triple H has been the head of creative and Vince has been out. But I'm starting to see, we're seeing at least a month of WWE doing better in ratings. Definitely Raw. It's hard to tell with SmackDown. SmackDown is partially preempted because of the NFL preseason. I think this is Does the NFL regular season start next week or the week after that? We have one more week of preseason.
Preseason is done. Yeah.
Preseason is done. Yeah. So Tuesday's cuts days where they have to make the roster, but the opener isn't until not this Thursday, but the Thursday after, which is Bills Rams.
Okay. So the season opener is on Amazon September 8th then?
Actually, Amazon starts week two. So
it starts week two. So who's playing the first regular season of the game?
I think it's NBC, but don't quote me 100% quote me on that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, SmackDown is harder to read. I think Dynamite's doing okay, but anyway, we'll get into it. If people want to participate, Gull, how do they do that?
Yeah. So, they can hit the super chat button with their question on YouTube and put any dollar amount that you see fit. We will answer those as best as we can throughout the show, but we will answer all the super chats.
I guess we'll start with the quarter hours actually first. So the quarter hours for this past Wednesday's AEW Dynamite with the Jon Moxley and CM Punk match, peaked at nearly 2 million viewers. The only quarter with 1.1 million viewers or greater, across the eight quarters of Dynamite, more than 500,000 in the demo. What is 500,000 in the demo in terms of a demo rating, that people are probably more familiar with? So we had 512,000 viewers. Did I say 500 million? 512,000 viewers in the demo divided by 1304.5 is what? That's a 0.39 in the demo. 0.39 in the demo is where this peaked. It averaged 0.34 in the demo. I don't read a ton into this other than the obvious that there was peak interest in this three-minute world title match between Jon Moxley and CM Punk. Grew sequentially 16% quarter to quarter in total viewership, 19% in the demo. In my magic formulas, it definitely qualified as something that would have made the list of things that would count in our Who's a Draw podcast. The two quarters prior to it were stronger than usual in sequential growth too, or at least retention. Usually quarter three drops by 10% in the demo. It did not, despite having a Colton Gunn versus Billy Gunn match in it. It also had that Thunder Rosa promo where she announces that she's injured and not going to defend the title at the pay-per-view. And the quarter after that grew more than usual in the demo too, which included what? The Death Triangle promo with United Empire, the Kylan King and Britt Baker match, and her post-match angle and promo with Toni Storm and Sheeta. So I would say like these two quarters, QH3 and QH4, which were right before the title match, those doing especially good. It's even more impressive that the Moxley Punk match was able to grow the audience further, I would say, because I guess the better your quarters before you do, the harder it is for you to do as well in this sort of analysis. So and then the following quarter, as expected, did lose viewership, which included the Ricky Starks live promo. That's all I really read into that right off the top. But anything to add there?
What jumps out to me is it looks like from your chart here that the drop off from quarter five to quarter six, while significant, seems to be low. Is that lower than it normally is? Right. So if I'm reading this chart correctly.
QTQ, so this is the sequential change for the given quarter. So QH6, which included the Ricky Starks live promo, that lost 13% of the demo. It usually loses 6%. So it lost more than usual.
All right, so I was reading that wrong. Can you read anything into that as far as, you know, people frustratingly, I can't believe it was a squash match and clicking off from what they saw, or do you think that was to be expected? This number is to be expected from the drop off from a world title, big world title match to the Ricky Starks promo.
I think, especially in this era of TV, that there's going to be, especially when you have something as heavily hyped as this match was, this title match was, that when it's over with, you're going to have significant tune out, and there was. I don't read anything particularly negative into a decline in viewership here. You have a big peak, and then after a big peak, you have a big big degree of tune out. It's worth mentioning too that so this QH5 included nothing but the wrestling program's content. QH6 with followed it had two ad breaks in it, which I'm sure contributed to a decline in viewership as well.
What do you think about having this match at the 9 o'clock slot? We've seen AEW really likes to experiment with their major matches. If they have a really big match, sometimes they'll do it at the start of the show. Sometimes they'll save it for the main event. This time they're putting it at the 9 o'clock slot. What did you think about that kind of strategy? I thought the way they rolled it out was very interesting because if I recall correctly, if you're watching the show, they really just, you know, Punk and Moxley is coming up and then, you know, Punk and Moxley came out and they had the match and then they had the finish and then they had the little post-match thing and it all happened. There were no commercial breaks. There were no, you know, breakups in the broadcast. It was all one very smooth, quick, you know, 10-minute segment from, you know, the guys coming out to the guys going to the back. And I thought it was all very interesting, kind of the strategy of not going to commercials and not really hyping up the match on the show that much. There was no promo packages before. There was no guys, you know, backstage promo before in the 8 o'clock hour. It was all very quickly streamlined through in like a 10-15 minute span.
Yeah, I'm guessing maybe part of the strategy is that they thought, let's put this big match, which is being hyped as perhaps the biggest match in Dynamite history. Let's put that at the top of the hour and then deliver great stuff after that. And this spectacular 6-man tag in the main event. I think that's, a worthy strategy. And if you look at the demo and how the demo performed, the last two quarters in the demo performed better than any of QH2 through 4. So if people are watching on YouTube, that's probably clearer to understand, right? Here we have 438, 444 for the last two quarters, and that's doing better than anything in the first half of the show, except for QH1, which is probably heavily influenced by the Big Bang Theory lead-in, which almost always coincides with a really strong first quarter hour. So I think that's fine.
Those last two quarters also were a notably long wrestling match, which as we've seen throughout AEW's history, when they do put out a 20 to 25 plus minute match, we usually see kind of growth as the match goes on. So it wasn't like they were doing, the women's match and then the main event. It was that last half hour, those last two quarters is essentially one match.
Yeah. A rare Dynamite where a women's match does not inhabit QH6 or QH7. Yeah, the Britt Baker versus Kylie King match was in QH4. I think AEW has a belief that the long matches are good at sustaining or maybe even growing viewership, and I see that in quarter hours. I rarely see minute-by-minute data, but I see that in quarter hours. I think if you go back and look at even the Iron Man, the 30-minute Iron Man match between Kenny Omega and Pac, you would see, even despite the audience knowing that this is going to be a 30-minute match, that retained the viewership quite well as opposed to like we'd have to go back and look at old observers, but I want to say the quarter hours that the Observer reported in the Ironman match from 2003 or was it 2000 no it has to be 2003 between Angle and Brock Lesnar on SmackDown in September 2003, I think that had a big tune in for the beginning of the match, 60 minutes later big tune in for the end of the match, and a lot of loss in between. But in this era, a lot of long matches, including this was definitely not a long match, this title match, but you're talking about the 6-man main event, which went across two quarters. But the Blood and Guts match, which was very long, it was nearly an hour, that retained viewership pretty well. And we've seen other matches like the CM Punk and MJF match that was quite long. Obviously, there's been the Danielson match, the 30 minutes with Omega, the 60 minutes with Paige, the about 30 minutes in the rematch, I believe, with Paige. All of those
we saw it the previous week with the Daniel Garcia Bryan Danielson match.
Yeah, true. Yeah. So I don't know. More long matches on TV, or I wouldn't hesitate to put a long match on TV.
The question about that, obviously this model works for Dynamite. Why don't they really do it for Rampage? I mean, I know they only get an hour, but would they maybe really successful at doing one really long match on Rampage every Friday to kind of keep that audience? Because we see it just. It's already low as,
I wouldn't be opposed to that. I think Rampage, I think there's just so much stuff that, that AEW wants to book and jam into the show that they, you know, you have an extra hour and a lot of stuff, you know, gets jammed in there rather than focusing on fewer things.
Yeah, Rampage just feels like an overflow show in a lot of ways, in the sense that it's the stuff that they want to get to, but they don't have time on Dynamite for it. That's why I feel like it's been a kind of a home for a lot of the Ring of Honor stuff, because they don't really have time to get to it on Dynamite, but it's kind of like this extra time. It's where they, you see them, you know, it's where like they've put Hook on Rampage a lot. I feel like it's kind of a place where they almost park some of their longer term projects and things like that, because Dynamite's such a tight schedule and they just kind of, they'd rather have like four matches on Rampage. But I think that's a good point, Gullo. I think, like, especially because the way Rampage's trends is usually it starts off and then declines greatly as the show goes on. If you were to start Rampage with like a 30-minute match, I think that would probably prove to be perhaps more productive in maintaining that audience from the start, as opposed to just kind of slowly whittling them down throughout the four or five matches that you have kind of speed running through the hour.
I mean, the Rampage that we attended in Rochester, it wasn't a 30-minute match, but Kingston Kensuke, Takashita. Always was that had me interested way more than the rest of the show, which was a lot of 6 to 8 minute matches. Gone. I think that went 10 to 12, two segments, if I remember. But
yeah, I mean, it's a headwind anyway when you're at 10 o'clock, starting at 10 o'clock and getting later into the night. But yeah, maybe a longer match on Rampage isn't a bad idea. So anyway, again, they're super chats. But we have an update on the relationship between Warner Brothers Discovery and AEW. This report is coming from Fightful, from Will Washington, who reported, I believe this came out on Thursday or Friday. He writes, a source inside Warner Brothers Discovery talked to us briefly about their current relationship with AEW and noted that while they still have a significant amount of time left on their contract, AEW programming in its current form, quote, makes no negative waves, end quote, and overall holds up their end of the deal quite well, particularly when it comes to ratings performance. The Wrestling Observer newsletter on that day noted that word had come from Warner Brothers Discovery that they'd like the language toned down. It's a report from the Observer. So it must have been Friday. The story goes on. AEW tells us that they believe this was a quote taken out of context from the All Talent meeting on Wednesday regarding promos and talent going into business for themselves. The point was to stress that they could get network heat if they, quote, fly too close to the sun, end quote. But we're told this was not an edict from the network. So this flies in the face of some speculation and rumor that maybe AEW is going to get cut to 1 hour. The network must not be happy with AEW. At least according to this report from Fightful, that's not the case. And I've been told that AEW is trying to be proactive about language on the TV show. It's not something that the network has told them that they need to crack down on. So a good question that we need to start thinking about that comes to mind from the line in this report about how they still have a significant amount of time left on their contract. AEW has an option year that, if it's picked up at the option of Warner Brothers Discovery, would take their contract until the end of 2024. I guess you could be saying, in the event that they would not pick up the option, you'd still have over a year left. But I wonder if that option's already been picked up. But any thoughts on this report coming from Fightful that, you know, everything's fine between WBD and AEW?
It's so hard to parse this out. Like, the report, right, that, Dynamite is going to be cut down to 1 hour.
I don't think anybody's reporting that.
Right.
I think that's simply speculation.
The rumor that was going around bad faith trolling that comes with that, and kind of unfortunately gives it oxygen. I don't think anyone seriously ever thought that Warner Brothers is unhappy with Dynamite's performance. I could see maybe they might be unhappy with some other things that are happening in the organization, but the concept of, like, they're going to get rid of their highest rated show that's not the NBA, basically, and not playoff hockey. And they'd be frustrated by it. They're going to cut it down to an hour. It just doesn't make any real logical sense. You know what's really interesting, Brandon, is I'm sorry to spring this on you, but I was listening to an episode of The Town with Matt Bellany. Mm-hmm. This was from the August 11th episode. He was talking to a woman named Jessica Elrich, who's an analyst of BNA Securities, just like talking a lot about the streaming wars and kind of what's happening with the various big streamers. And they were talking about Warner Brothers Discovery, and they said that a lot of Warner Brothers Discovery moves, especially the moves that we've discussed over the last month or so here, have been different than their rival major media companies that own streaming services, which is Warner Brothers Discovery has become much more kind of like cash oriented in the sense that they are consistently, they're trying to get paid for their content now, and they're not doing as many proactive moves that a lot of the other companies have been doing to kind of use, you know, pay for things that are going to be loss leaders to help buoy things like your fledgling streaming service, right? They're taking movies and they are either canceling them or they're putting them in theaters only. They're not putting them on HBO Max. They're really being progressive in the sense that they just want to get paid for the projects that they're doing. They're not making these kind of long-term game investments. And a lot of that is because they have a lot of debt to pay off. But a lot of it is because this is the situation that they found themselves in, as opposed when it comes to this merger, and they're not going to be like a Disney Plus or, I guess Disney Plus would be the perfect example of kind of things like, we're not going to release this movie in theaters. It's going to be a Disney Plus project. It will make less money, but we want to get Disney Plus going further. And, Peacock obviously is doing a similar model. So I just found that kind of interesting as far as Warner Brothers Discovery's position on a lot of their future moves and how AEW fits into that move. Is that something that they're going to be willing to invest in? I don't know. I don't know how it fits in, but I just found the discussion very interesting.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, go ahead. No, Jesse, I think there is not a lot of investing on there. And I think the proactiveness that maybe Tony Khan and AEW are trying to do is because I can't see now in this world any AEW properties going on the streaming devices of Discovery Plus or what's left of HBO Max for the next year. I just can't see it happening. Yeah. So I think Tony Khan's trying to be proactive to think that there might be a glimmer of hope of that happening, you know, keep the relationship good. But they're taking a lot of properties off HBO Max that you would think is unnecessary. I think, and I said it on here a couple weeks ago, I think they're going to sell the DC Comics properties, which will be a huge, huge deal. I just think it's a company that doesn't want anything that's not in their model of the Magnolia Network type television shows. You know, they're not going to put on those streaming services, but I think Tony Khan thinks there's still a chance.
Yeah. I would say the language may have as much or more to do with advertisers and sponsors that as the network. We're seeing these big media companies, whether it's the traditional broadcast networks or the major streamers or the major tech companies that are getting into streaming like Amazon and Apple, all have different strategies and different situations that they're in. People have looked at Netflix and look at all the money that Netflix has poured into content and how that paid off for them. Now they've ended up with their subscribers flatlining, you know, plateauing out earlier than their stock market, than their stock price had indicated about a year ago, right? Their stock price is way down from where it was. But everybody saw that, a lot of people, including Comcast, NBCU, saw that strategy, and Disney saw that strategy, and they're dumping and have dumped and will dump a lot of money, billions of dollars, into producing their own content because the cable bundle is declining, and apparently streaming is the future, and streaming is now probably overinvested in, and the moment that Netflix failed to report a quarter with sequential growth in their subscribers, it was sort of this wake-up moment. And Fox is now looking great in terms of being the one big media company of this group that has not invested much of anything in streaming, with the exception of Tubi. According to Chris Gull, that's the future home of W's next day rights. Remains to be seen, though. But Fox looks smart in terms of they're not dumping all this money into a service that who knows when or if it will ever really pay off. And as you, as Jesse mentioned, there's a lot of debt coming from this merger of Warner Media and Discovery. And I think certainly the CFO of Warner Brothers Discovery, Gunnar Weidenfeld, is critical of the Warner Media financial strategy that he inherited. And I think they want to invest in fewer, more popular, and more lucrative properties. Fewer rather than a lot, rather than being Peacock and dumping billions of dollars into lots and lots of stuff. Very few things and making smart investments, I think, is their something along the lines of their thinking. So fewer, the most popular stuff. Does AEW fall into that? Maybe. Because it is 52 weeks a year, and it often ranks number one in 18 to 49 in the demo. It does fairly well. We're probably going to get into WWE improving in some ways economically lately. That doesn't mean that AEW is disimproving, only that it's, you know, sort of staying where it is. But we'll see what happens. And ultimately, whether AEW gets an increase or not will depend on how interested other players, like perhaps Fox, maybe NBCU, maybe Disney, maybe major streaming players, maybe smaller streaming players, how interested those companies are in AEW's variety of rights that they might be able to offer, including Live Dynamite, including Live Rampage, including Next Day, that has no home right now for Dynamite and Rampage. So, moving on. Put our slides back on the screen here. So I wanted to talk about, and feel free to debate me here, that I'm seeing a number of different ways that WWE is showing that it has positive momentum. And I'm seeing this in ways that are different from the ways in which I've heard other people talk about how WWE has positive momentum. So first of all, I want to look at the live attendance, live event attendance. This is data from WrestleTix. And let's focus on SmackDown and Raw, and in contrast to Dynamite, because I think that's the fairest comparison. House shows that I've heard some people talk about, house shows being up, are not up. In Q3, so far, according to WrestleTix tickets distributed, house shows are averaging about 3,800 on average at the house shows in Q3. We're about two-thirds of the way through Q3, two out of the 3 months. 3,800 tickets out is the average for house shows, which is down. That it's been down every quarter since the return to touring. It was way up to 6,900 in the return to touring last year, Q3. Then it went down to 4,900. Then it went down to 4,300. Then it went down to 4,000 even. And now it's down to 3,800. So house shows continue to kind of diminish. However, Raw and SmackDown in this quarter so far are up over the prior quarter. And in fact, are at their highest point since the Q3 of last year, which had a massive tailwind from the return to touring, from the so-called pent-up demand of people not being able to go to live events for the prior year and a half or whatever it was. So Raw and SmackDown, SmackDown is averaging in Q3 8,500 tickets distributed. That's up from 7,000 in the last couple quarters just for SmackDown. For Raw, Raw is up to about 9,600. That's up from in the high 6,000s the last two quarters. Meanwhile, Dynamite is down to about averaging 5,000, which is where it was in Q1, but it was doing better in Q2 with 6,300. But you can, if we go to the next slide, we can see the trend a little bit more closely here, where, you know, for these three quarters in between, SmackDown and Raw are lower, and in the Q3 of last year, the Q3 of this year, Raw and SmackDown are both up. In fact, Raw is somehow averaging higher. Is that reflected in the other table? Yes. Raw is somehow averaging a higher average right now in Q3 of this year than in the return to touring Q3, which I hadn't realized until right this moment. So live attendance is up. Anything to add there before we do some geography?
I'll have a broader point. I'll bring it up when you talk. When I talk year over year ratings, but I think Dynamite to me seems to have a lot of really, and we're seeing this, I guess, now with some of these really big WWE shows that have popped up over the last few weeks for both Raw and SmackDown. Dynamite always seems, especially because its history is less, we have less of it than WWE. Seems to have their show seems to have quite a bit of fluctuation between where they're going to be. I think they have kind of a standard like 4,500 to 5,000 attendance crowd when they are kind of run. I think that's like their average that they pretty much hover around regardless of where they are. And then they'll have, when they're in a big market for the first time, they'll have these really big shows that do 9,000 to 11,000 people. We've seen them do those kind of big crowds in Detroit and do the big crowds in New York at the Newark, New Jersey show and the Grand Slam show and the Los Angeles show. And when they make their debuts in some of these new markets, they tend to draw very, very well. And that's kind of a really big fluctuation that I think, I don't know if it's a big enough sample size to kind of explain some of these Dynamite numbers in Q3. I think if, especially over the past month or so, Dynamite hasn't really been in what I would consider marquee markets. I'm just kind of looking through their last few months. These aren't necessarily running. I mean, they were in Cleveland this week. I'd consider that a good market, not a giant market. Before that, they were in Charleston, West Virginia, which is a small market. They're in Minneapolis the week before that. Again, a good market, but not one of the largest markets in the country. Columbus, Ohio, similar. Worcester, Massachusetts. I have my own thoughts on running Worcester. Duluth, Georgia, small market. Savannah, Georgia, small market. I guess Duluth's technically Atlanta, but it's not really Atlanta. You know, Rochester, New York. To me, it's not, I don't know if that's enough like fluctuation to kind of explain it, but they have not been running in the past few months really like I would consider like their major markets, which are New York and Chicago, or Los Angeles. Some of the markets where I think they would draw better, but
yeah. So if we look at the cities that AEW has been to, as opposed to the cities that WWE has been to, obviously WWE runs way more events and they run house shows and they run two weekly TV shows every week. Dynamite runs one show most weeks. But if we look at, here's a map of, for people watching on YouTube, here's a map of the major cities by population. The bigger your bubble is here, the bigger your population is, just to give you an idea of where are the populated areas in the United States. And then if we look at where WWE has been, that looks pretty similar, right, to what the big cities are. It seems like WWE, again, with its many more shows, has covered a lot more territory than, say, AEW here with fewer shows, but still AEW as far as the West Coast has not been, and I didn't label this, but has not been to Denver yet, I guess. Is that right? Has not been to Denver. I'm only talking since July 2021. I think they might
have been to Colorado. I think they have been to Colorado. It's not Denver. I forget the name of the city that they were in. I don't know if it was Lakewood, maybe, but
probably close to Denver.
Yeah, they ran a show. They did. They definitely have run a show in Denver before. And yeah, I know they ran in Salt Lake City, but that was before.
You're muted, Golo.
I was going to say, yeah, I think that was right before the pandemic that they did Denver. Yes. But
yeah, because they did Salt Lake City. I think Salt Lake City might have been the last one they ran.
It was
before the pandemic.
Oklahoma City is a big market that they have not gone to. That's a huge population.
Local draw, Jim Ross there. Sells tickets.
You know, but we talked, I mean, the West Coast, I get logistically the time, but Portland and Seattle, you would think would be slam dunks for them to go to. And the fact that they haven't makes no sense, especially with the talent that they have from there too.
Yeah.
Phoenix is another major town they haven't been to. They haven't been to the Bay Area, which includes San Jose, San Francisco, Oakland, haven't been to San Diego yet. Sacramento would not be in the same market as the Bay Area. Is that right?
No. Yeah, no, those would be different. The Sacramento people and the Bay Area people would get mad at you. I think it's just yeah.
Apologies. I'll try to work on that. I also have Salt Lake City labeled. Again, they were there pre-pandemic, but since the last year have not been there yet. And we also have Tucson. I think Tucson and Phoenix are in different markets, right?
Don't know that much about Southern Arizona. I would say that, yes, they are different.
And even Tampa, I found. They've been to some places that are maybe like within a two-hour drive. I think Estero was within a two-hour drive of Tampa, but nothing closer than that. So there's all those things.
Well, they've been in Orlando, which I think is close to Tampa. I think that's within 90 minutes, but...
Okay.
How much does arena size play into this, like, where that maybe there is a hesitant of going to some of these big cities because they only have the big major league arenas, so they go to a little bit of the smaller cities because they have the college arenas, which is what they normally target, though, for the logistics as far as seating.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. There may be issues just finding venues. I don't know.
I have a bunch of different theories on AEW's touring. The first one I have is similar to what Gallo just said, which is that some of these other cities do not have big arenas, or maybe only have one big arena that they can't get into for whatever reason. A lot of people would speculate that that's WWE stamping them out of the arena. I think you can look to certain arenas and say, it's kind of suspicious they haven't been there. WWE runs in that building a lot, so perhaps that's why they haven't been there. That's one reason. I've heard the idea that since I believe AEW is a Jacksonville-related company, just logistically, it might be more difficult for them to get their ring crew and everything they need from Jacksonville to Seattle. And, okay, you could draw a bigger house in Seattle, but at some point, is it better for a cost perspective to keep running more on the East Coast and on the Midwest than it is to drive all the way across the other corner of the country? I also sometimes think that Tony Khan knows that the first show he has in some of these bigger markets is going to be a really big deal. We've seen that in Los Angeles. We've seen that in Detroit. We've seen that in New York. And maybe he's keeping some of those markets for the big debut and trying to space those out over time so they're not all just bundled up one after another. I think it was notable that they like kind of went to Los Angeles and everyone was like, oh, when they're in Los Angeles, that means they're going to do, you know, San Francisco the next week, and then they'll go to Portland, and then they'll go to Seattle. And it was, nope, we're going back east. So I think all of those could be some form of a factor that kind of explains why AEW is kind of not hit some of these major markets when you would think from any planning perspective you'd want to get into them.
To add on that, Brandon.
This, of course, is only the U.S., not including Canada.
That's a separate issue. I think they should be all over Canada.
Yeah. But Toronto did sell out those tickets that went on sale this past week, at least for one of the shows, if not. I know they're doing Rampage and a Dynamite, but I believe the Dynamite is sold out. Go ahead, Gull.
Well, if you notice, a lot of these markets are in clusters, right? And to kind of add to what Jesse was saying with the logistics with ring crew and production and all that, also, too, their talent only works once a week, right? So it's not like they could have a built-in live touring schedule like WWE does, where it's like, hey, we're going to do Portland, but then we're going to do Montana, Idaho, all that, getting us to San Jose a week later. Like, there isn't that type of touring where, you know, these talents, they fly in on Tuesday, they do their show Wednesday, they fly out on Thursday, and they're not back again till Tuesday. And wherever they're flying from, maybe it's just they want their talent to be happy and not have that type of, hey, you got to stay in the Pacific Northwest for a week for this to work.
It probably makes everything more expensive. But AEW has been to a number of areas multiple times. I've got the Hoffman Estates and Chicago separated here. Hoffman Estates, as I'm considering going to Chicago next week, I would say it's in the Chicago market, but it is way out of the way. This is where the Now Arena is. This is where the All-In pay-per-view was also in 2018. They have done, since the return to touring, I think this is correct, they've done 5 shows in Hoffman Estates. They have done, or they're going to do, this is includes the shows that are coming up next week. 5 shows in Hoffman Estates, 5 shows in Chicago, elsewhere, 10 shows in the Chicago market in the last year. I want to double check that. That sounds so high. But anyway, they've done 4 in Washington, D.C., 3 in Pittsburgh, 3 in Philadelphia, 3 in Orlando, 3 in Minneapolis, 3 in Miami, 3 in Las Vegas, 3 in Jacksonville, 3 in Garland. Garland is near Austin or Dallas. And they have Garland that is near one of those, and they have another suburb that's near the other one. And they've been to other markets twice that people can see on the screen. So they've been to a lot of the same markets over and over again. And one thing I learned from studying John Cena several years ago is that people fairly bring up when you talk about attendances and you talk about differences in attendances over time, let's say from this quarter to the last quarter. Well, what's the difference in the market mix? Maybe they were just going, attendance is up in this quarter. Well, maybe they're just going to bigger markets. Maybe they're going to New York and LA and Chicago in this quarter, and you're comparing the other quarter where they went to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Anchorage, Alaska or something. And so I think the fairest way to look at this stuff is, it's hard to get examples of this, but you want to get the same type of event when it comes to wrestling. So it's a TV taping, compare a TV taping to a TV taping and compare it in the same market. So we do have 12 examples since the return to touring where AEW has done a Dynamite taping. So not a pay-per-view, not a Rampage or a Battle of the Belts only, but a Dynamite taping in the same market more than once. And that is Boston, Chicago, Duluth, Georgia, Houston, Independence, which is near St. Louis, Jacksonville, Long Island, Milwaukee, Newark, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Rochester. 12 markets where they've gone to do Dynamite at least twice, in some cases three times, in the case of Chicago, in the case of Jacksonville. I believe I've merged Chicago and Hoffman Estates here. Anyway, 12 times. Four of those cases, they drew better later than they did earlier. Determining this by calculating a slope if people are interested in the math here. But four out of the 12, that's one third. If we compare that to WWE, and now I remember mentioning a couple weeks ago that we're coming up on Q3, we're coming up on the time that there's a return to touring, we can start making comparisons about live event attendance year over year. So that's AEW's market-to-market performance in this year. How's WWE doing? So let's just look at the Raws and SmackDowns. Group the Raws and SmackDowns together, assuming they're equal. You could argue that Friday is a better night. It could be. But we have, I won't name them all because there's 34 of them. People can see what they are on the screen if they're watching on YouTube. But there's 34 markets where WWE has done a Raw and or a SmackDown more than once. And out of those 34 markets, in 16 of them, nearly half, in 16 of them, they have drawn better later than they did earlier. In many cases, they have drawn better later than they did in that return to touring quarter, which I found surprising. Does this mean that WWE is doing better than it was, at some point in recent history?
I mean, I think so. I think the last... I might be wrong, but it seems to me like the last 2 months of WWE, the company has garnered more positive momentum and feels like more of a positive trend than in quite a few number of years. It feels like, and part of that is just a narrative change. I think that's mainly the main reason is that now I think people genuinely feel optimistic that the product is going to improve if it has not improved already. And that is getting a lot of people back out, either watching the show on a weekly basis or attending shows live. As you see, a lot of those Q3 numbers compared to, either earlier this year, Q1 or the, 2021 have been doing quite well. And I mean, if you just see, it used to be, the 2022 quarter one, Dynamite was drawing better than Raw on average attendance. And that seems almost really hard to believe now because Raw is doing, Raw in Toronto did what, 14,000 people on Monday night?
I believe so, yeah.
It's double what what it has been. So it definitely seems to me just that they're definitely distributing more tickets is what I'll say.
I think Dynamite outdid Raw and maybe even SmackDown, certainly in September of last year, which is this incredibly hot period. I've realized that in hindsight for AEW. And I think there's a month, we're looking at quarterly averages here, but I think there's a month in early 2022 where Dynamite outdid Raw and or SmackDown for tickets distributed according to the WrestleTix data. By the way, I'm getting all this data from WrestleTix. So that's live attendance. I see momentum here in the sequential analysis of WWE's live attendance. I'm seeing a positive trend in the more fair market to market. You could say, well, maybe they're just up in Q3 versus some other times because of different markets. Well, market to market, they're looking, well, at least better than AEW's looking.
Yeah, and I do think that needs to be some perspective put in the sense that there seem to be, realistically, if you look at this without AEW comparison, Raw and SmackDown, seems to be pretty flat, right? They're positive in about the same amount of markets as they are negative. It seems to be almost a wash between some markets are up and some markets are down. We can compare it to AEW and say, well, they're doing better than AEW, but AEW is also coming off of, in a lot of instances, the debuts in these markets, which always seem to draw better than the return, because you're not going to be able to get all the fans back that you got for your debut. In WWE, we're talking about decades and decades of them running in these markets and the fluctuation that comes from that. And is that a real fair comparison when we're talking about maybe only one or two previous shows in the AEW market?
Well, how about this? If we look at just Q3, which is our current quarter, which is not yet complete, right? We have 11 markets that they're returning to for TV, 11. So Boston is slightly up from a year ago. Cleveland is down. Houston is down. They're up from the Q4 when they were there in Q4. They're not up from the Q3 of last year, which is where they, I believe they did the first Raw, I want to say, or maybe the first SmackDown on the return to touring in Houston. New York is Madison Square Garden. It's slightly up. Orlando is slightly up. Phoenix is down. Again, that's a return to touring. Raleigh is up. San Antonio is up from Q4. San Diego is down. Tampa is slightly up. And many of those comparisons are against Q3 of last year, which you would think would have a tailwind from the return to touring, this Q3 not having that tailwind. So there's that. We can talk about TV ratings, too. This is still the case, as it was on Wednesday. Yeah, because there's been no new TV ratings since Wednesday. There's only one TV show in August. In August, we'll have one more Raw in it. Yeah, it'll have one more Raw and one more Dynamite in it, and one more NXT. But there's only one TV show among all the nationally televised wrestling TV shows. I did exclude Impact here, but this also applies for Impact. There's only one TV show that is up both in total viewership and in the demo year over year. And there's really only one show, in fact, that's up in the demo year over year in August, and that's Raw, which is up 3% in the demo, up 7% in total viewership. Impact is also up, I believe, in total viewership year over year, but not in the demo. Everybody else is at least a little bit down. SmackDown is down by 2%. Some of that, well, I guess it is comparing. SmackDown is still being compared against the August in which it also had to go against NFL preseason, so maybe that's kind of a fair comparison. But Dynamite is down from August, when that was starting to become a pretty hot period for Dynamite, which by this time last year, CM Punk was back. I think we were in the first week of CM Punk being back. But Raw doing pretty well and doing better than it was last year. Raw did an enormous rating right after SummerSlam. And it's not as high as that in episodes following it, but it's holding up better than I would expect in a normal situation if there weren't other things that may be affecting the rating, perhaps including a new head of creative. And not just the curiosity about that news story, but about the actual, you know, maybe the content is just better also.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I wanted to ask you, I thought about this when I looked at the live attendance numbers and also when I look at the television ratings, but the last few years, SmackDown has taken the mantle of being the A show from Raw. WWE clearly is more invested in SmackDown than they are in Raw, despite Raw being the historical flagship show and Raw having, you know, a very lucrative television deal, technically more lucrative than SmackDown's deal. But since SmackDown is on Fox, you know, SmackDown is clearly the favorite show. It's where Roman Reigns is. It's where the world titles seem to sit and never move. And so SmackDown is the A show for WWE. That being said, it seems to me the trend that we see, and obviously it's maybe a little hard to parse with SmackDown's television numbers in August because, like you said, the preseason has been preempted. But Raw seems to be the big beneficiary from this kind of shakeup in organizational leadership that we've seen. It seems like Raw is benefiting a lot, both in live attendance and in ratings. And Raw's pretty competitive with SmackDown in both 18 to 49 and in total viewers for the most part, which really shouldn't be the case when you consider the strength of Fox relative and the number of homes Fox is in relative to a cable station like USA Network. And I was thinking about that, and I was wondering, despite the fact that WWE has kind of put all this effort into making SmackDown their A show, Raw still seems to have the cachet as being the most important show to watch if you're a WWE fan, especially if you're perhaps a lapsed fan who has not been watching over the last few years and have decided to tune back in more regularly now that you found out that Triple H is in charge. And obviously, if you're that kind of fan, you're going to watch Raw because in your mind, Raw is still the A show. Even if you've been following closely over the last few years, it's clear that SmackDown is the A show.
And Raw doesn't have – it has had Roman Reigns on a few times, right? But Raw has not had Roman Reigns on for the most part. He's mostly on SmackDown, right?
Right, and Brock Lesnar and, like, these – you know, your – SmackDown has gotten the big Ronda Rousey, whatever your big stars are you have. SmackDown is the favored show. It's what Raw used to be, and that's been the case over the last few years. But yet – I think if you were to survey a lot of fans, Raw still holds that kind of cachet as the A show. And you can see, as Brandon has this chart right here, that shows that since the kind of regime change and the Vince scandal and whatever you want to talk about, Raw has really caught up to SmackDown, is about level with them in total viewers over the last 2 months.
How much of it is a convenience of day, too? Like, you know, obviously SmackDown has a network platform, but it's still Friday, and right. I think Friday is such a rough day.
That's been the case since October 2019, though. That's not changed.
No,
and look at back in history, and then SmackDown's been decisively ahead.
But now that the product is getting better,
yeah, and casual like, or lapsed yeah. fans might be more likely to watch Raw, right, than SmackDown. Yeah. Like, I think in some regards, like Gullo said, like, because if you're like a lapsed fan, you're maybe not clearing out your Friday night to watch SmackDown, but you're more likely to be home and watch Raw.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I've been doing, honestly. Like, since Triple H has taken over, I have caught myself watching Raw every Monday, at least part of it, if not all of it. I still haven't watched a SmackDown yet.
Because it's on Friday, right?
Yep, yeah.
You have a busy, successful life, Gullo. to Gullo's point also, like, the attendance to me almost, like, suggest that, because the attendance also, I don't know if you can go back to the quarterly attendance things, but if you look at Raw's attendance in this quarter is bigger than SmackDown's So if we look at Q3 Raw, as that looks like 9,600. SmackDown's at 8,500. So Raw's drawing better than SmackDown. Now, maybe Raw has been in maybe a few bigger markets and better buildings or whatever. But that really shouldn't be the case because, as we know, Raw is on Monday nights and SmackDown is on Friday nights. And typically, if you're a live entertainment, it's better to draw on a Friday night, a weekend night, than on a weekday night, like Raw is. So while SmackDown might have be at a disadvantage when it comes to viewership because it is on a Friday night as opposed to a Monday night, it should have an advantage in live attendance. And yet Raw is still, you know, was considerably ahead of them this week or this last quarter. And I think that's also kind of notable. I think Raw is seeing a big rebound and maybe SmackDown is more of leveled off.
I just want to quickly look at year-over-year comparisons here, too, where you can see Dynamite. We're only going to look at the demo here. Dynamite is basically on par with where it was in 2020. So if we think about 2020, that's still the Monday Night War, or I'm sorry, the Wednesday Night War. That ended in April 2021. So the demo, now you've got to consider that, you know, it's harder to maintain viewership over time and the number of homes that TNT or TBS is in. I should say TNT/TBS, but Dynamite is about where it was in 2020. It is below in the blue line here where it was in 2021. Rampage is well below where it was last year. This enormous spike here is the CM Punk episode, but it's even if we just look at year to date, so this is at the very beginning of this green line, this is the beginning of the year, and it's clearly a negative trend going downward, maybe flattening here in the last 10 weeks or so. SmackDown is about where it was in 2020. In some weeks, it's comparable to last year in the return to touring. Where ratings did, you know, my read of the ratings last year was, yes, SmackDown and Raw held up in the ratings a lot better than I expected them to. I thought there might be a couple weeks of increased interest, but it really sustained longer than I expected it to. I got stuff in the way of my Raw chart. Raw is remarkably similar across this year and the prior 2 years in the demo. The green line is in some cases above either 2021 or 2020. The green line is 2022. So very comparable viewership. It's almost as if cord cutting isn't happening if you only look at the Raw trend lines here. After, to be clear, years and years of year-over-year declines for Raw, for the most part. There's like a couple years in there where they didn't decline strongly, but for the most part, annual declines for Raw. NXT, we see a little bit of a positive trend here for the last several weeks of NXT, but obviously still doing well below, for the most part, with some exceptions, doing well below where it has been in the last 2 years, despite not having to go against AEW, which again ended in April 2021. And I think this chart really tells a lot to me about what the momentum is in major professional wrestling. This is what's the margin of difference in the demo between Dynamite in the same week as Raw and SmackDown. And over time, that margin lead, it's clearly, it's well above, you know, Raw and SmackDown are well above where Dynamite is. Almost always, there's like 2 weeks in history so far, which were both last year, September, where Dynamite barely edged out live same day, Raw, in the same week. Just barely. But this margin for Raw and SmackDown over Dynamite started out pretty big, and then over time has shrunk. Some of that coincides with Dynamite not going against NXT anymore. That helped. And it's not a straight line down to the right. There have been bumps in this. There have been times, in fact, I guess this is September 2020. Would that be, I guess, the beginning of the Thunderdome era, where Raw and SmackDown kind of increased their margin momentarily before it flattened out and then declined further, which that decline really started in about April 2021, which is when the Wednesday Night War came to an end. Dynamo was no longer opposed by NXT, and Dynamite shrunk that margin between itself and Raw and SmackDown. And then it's been pretty flat throughout this year and late last year. And ever since what looks to be about June or so, summer and forward, that that margin for Raw and SmackDown has grown. So Raw and SmackDown are slightly extending their lead, and it's a trend. This is the lines that people are looking at here on YouTube. This is the 10-week moving average. So that's what this line is. And that line is going up for Raw and SmackDown. Raw and SmackDown are improving their lead over Dynamite. So that tells me, I think that's a good summary of what's happening here. And is it meaningful or not, or to what degree it is meaningful? Time will tell, but this feels real to me. And let's briefly look at Google Trends. I just did this sort of for the sake of doing it, just to fully investigate and cover all bases here, but I don't see that much that's really meaningful here in Google Trends. WWE is well ahead of AEW by about four times, I believe, is the factor here between WWE and AEW. The long course of time here from 2014 and forward, particularly from 2016 and forward, is a down to the right trend for WWE that is flattening out. By the way, why do we care about Google Trends? This is Google Web Search. It often does coincide with other consumer-driven metrics that actually have to do with people spending money, including ticket sales, sometimes TV ratings, merchandise sales, and things like that. Pay-per-view buys, it has actually...
Are these worldwide trends?
This is worldwide that we're looking at, yes. Dynamite has grown from its inception through the debut of CM Punk, and is a lot of volatility here, I would say, but not much to draw. Is WWE's improvement perhaps in popularity of late, does that have something to do with Roman Reigns and how strongly Roman Reigns is being booked? Roman Reigns web search trends have a lot of, I would say they coincide quite a bit with just what WWE is doing. I think I see that with most everybody, like individual stars. Their web search tends to be up or down. Their web search tends to be better in 2015, 2016 than it was in years later, when just the web search for WWE in general declined. But we see, you know, big spikes around the time that he's making his announcements about, you know, dealing with cancer and things like that. But we see, I don't know, we might see a slight positive trend here. And I think even if I zoom in, I could draw a positive trend line right here for 2021 and forward, which is roughly since he returned from his sabbatical early on in the pandemic.
It also coincides with things like the Peacock deal, right? And maybe more people watching your WWE pay-per-views on Peacock, and therefore getting someone like Roman Reigns more popularity.
For sure. CM Punk, we don't see a lot of clarity, at least at this level of granularity here. We see some spikes around the time of his debut in AEW, which, by the way, is well below the spikes that we saw at certain moments. I think this big spike right here that I'm pointing to with my mouse is, I believe, his exit from WWE. maybe that's even like the Cabana podcast. I don't know. And I think this big spike back here is the 2011 Money in the Bank moment. These are monthly data points we would be looking at here. And to briefly look at YouTube, we see a positive increase in the top five YouTube videos for SmackDown. Maybe an increase, maybe not, for Raw. An increase somewhat in YouTube for NXT. An increase in the last few weeks, anyway, for Dynamite. And an increase in the last several weeks, maybe, for AEW. If you believe... I cautiously believe that there's been an increase in popularity for WWE over the last 2 months. And I definitely believe that there's been a stabilization in the decline in WWE's popularity that has been precipitous from 2017 and onward. Why is it happening? Is it just Roman Reigns, the needle mover, being booked as strongly as he's being booked? I don't know. I think it has more to do with Peacock, though. And if we look at... other moments in history, in recent times, I think the WWE Network had a lot to do with a thing that's really underanalyzed. I don't think almost anybody... Is there anybody out there who talks frequently about how WWE had this increase in popularity from 2014 to 2016? I see it as evident here. Maybe not so much in viewership, although 2014, Raw at least didn't decline more than 1% year over year in 2014, the year that the W Network launched in February 2014. And from 2014, really back starting in 2012, but merchandise sales grew, both at the venue and online. From 2014 onward, peaking into 2017, product licensing, which includes things like video games and action figures and trading cards and various other categories of product licensing, that grew, which is driven by sales. That grew from 2014 to 2015 to 2016 to 2017. And live event attendance, paid attendance, grew from 2012 to 2013 to 2014 to 2015 to 2016 to 2017, every year, higher and higher. That's both in terms of total viewership in the entire year, or total attendance in the entire year, and average attendance in the entire year. And this is why I think Google Web Search, Google Trends are meaningful to look at over long periods of time. We see a similar trend in web search for WWE, both in the U.S. and worldwide, going from 2013 to 2016. Coinciding with the emergence of new big stars, maybe The Shield, maybe Roman Reigns, maybe. But I think more than anything, it was the W Network. People talk about how stars are draws, and certainly they can be. They were. Maybe they still are. I think some people, perhaps including Chris Cullo, have argued that the brand is the draw. Nothing matters anymore. The stars don't matter. I'm bastardizing some point that you may have been making. But I don't know if the brand, there's truth to these things. There's truth to these things. But maybe there's something else that's happening here. And maybe it's there's supposed to be distribution here. But I think Peacock is the thing that's coinciding with this now. You had the W Network, which back here we could see the W Network launch coincided with an increase in various metrics. And now we're seeing Peacock furthering the distribution of pay-per-view events, the peak content again, coinciding with the increase in various other categories. Right or wrong?
I mean, it's hard for me to argue against all that data. I think I've become a believer definitely in what you have laid out in the past, which is the WWE Network really increasing, you know, people's access to the pay-per-view events, which increased investment. I think there's a lot of trends that suggest Peacock is doing the same thing. And Peacock is really a minor streaming platform. It's definitely far below things like Netflix and Disney Plus. And it does make you wonder that if WWE were to ever get on, or perhaps another wrestling company were to ever get on either of those platforms, would they see an incredible increase in business, even if they don't necessarily have that, you know, the next Stone Cold Steve Austin on their roster?
Yeah, we've seen some relatively minor wrestling companies on Netflix, right? Lucha Underground was on Netflix for a minute. Wasn't there something associated with Ring of Honor?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've seen UFC see a big increase on ESPN since it's been on ESPN and ESPN Plus, and in that in UFC's business has gone up despite the fact that I think, in a lot of people's opinion, their star power has declined. Some of their biggest box office stars are either fighting less or not fighting at all, and yet UFC is really hot when it comes to selling pay per views and selling live event tickets and things like that. I think a lot of that goes with being with ESPN. That's kind of a different animal because ESPN is, on one hand, a network and a platform, but it is also a media machine that hypes up its own products and things like that. But I think we've seen plenty of, you know, Formula One obviously being the big example. Plenty of companies see in sports products see their business grow because they get platformed on these streaming networks and things like that.
And to put it into some tangible numbers, the W Network in the United States, and Peacock is only in the United States, W Network in the United States, worldwide, they peaked out at about 1.5 million. But in the U.S., that was about 1.1 million, maybe 1.2 at the absolute height. So 1.2 million homes, direct-to-consumer in the United States, subscribed to W Network. As of their last report, Comcast said that Peacock had 13 million subscribers. Now, that doesn't mean that people are watching. I'm sure that people are not watching W content on Peacock to the rate that people are watching W content who had it in their homes when they were direct subscribers. But it at least increases the number of people who have access to it, which has, according to WWE, has increased the number of people who are actually watching it, where they give us these percentage year-over-year differences for the particular pay-per-views, right? Which are now getting smaller. So this benefit that I'm arguing is happening here for WWE because of their being on Peacock, that benefit, which is still a benefit, is getting smaller over time. SummerSlam was only up 20% this year versus last year, as opposed to WrestleMania, I believe they have said, was up 60%. I've heard people talk about these percentage differences in the terms that, like, well, you can't judge that WWE's being more popular because of these you know, percentage differences in Peacock, because obviously there's more subscribers to Peacock. But yes, but Peacock is the reason why you're seeing all these other things. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, when you're talking about, like, year-over-year increases, we're now getting to a point, like, WrestleMania was up a ton year-over-year. Well, a part of that was because WrestleMania was in front of a tiny audience, essentially, because we were still in the pandemic in that sense. SummerSlam up less. Well, SummerSlam was a huge show in 2021. It was a stadium show in Las Vegas that drew very well. And so it's not – when it comes to the year-over-year, in addition to comparing, like, an event on Peacock from 2021 to an event on Peacock in 2022, we're now at the point where we're a year – at least a year plus removed from the return of, like, live touring the way we know it.
And Peacock probably had something like 8 million paid subscribers at that time, 7 million, maybe something like that. I believe the first time they revealed this, they had something like 9 million. Mm-hmm. And now – they have 13 million.
Well, you also have the people like the Comcast customers that are getting it for free. I don't know if they're counted as the paid subscribers, but they're people who have access to it.
Yeah, I don't know if they're counted as paid, but they give two metrics. They give paid subscribers, which is 13 million, and then they give monthly active accounts, which is 24 million. Both of those numbers from quarter to quarter in Q2 were the same as they were in Q1. So that growth for Peacock in terms of consumption, engagement, seems to have flattened. Right, because those numbers, they were growing and growing because it's a new service, and now they flattened at least from one quarter to the next in the most two recent quarters.
Yeah, well, if I recall correctly, I think part of the analysis on that was that in quarter one, I don't know, was the Super Bowl on Peacock this year?
Yes.
So quarter one, you have Peacock has the Super Bowl, obviously biggest event in American television by an enormous margin. And they also had a lot of Winter Olympics coverage. So you had a lot of people who were subscribing to it in quarter one for these two massive, huge events. Mm-hmm. Quarter two, you maybe you don't expect to see
growth because you had a tailwind in Q1 that does not exist.
Right. And so even remaining flat is maybe not as disastrous as people would think, because you don't have these two massive events that you're getting people subscribed up for.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What else did I have here? That's all I have. Anybody want to add anything else or bring anything else up?
Well, we got some super chats, so we'll get into that. Some interesting ones.
I may have seen one already.
Well, one interesting one. I'd say Timby. I'm tired of Brandon pushing Gullo down our throats. Sure, Jesse is here this week, but we'll be back to catering once Brandon is done with his new toy.
Well, I think Timby is just a part of the vocal minority, and really this causes controversy for WrestleNomics, and that's good for WrestleNomics. Really all this is just, you know, the babyface did not win. Santa Claus didn't come for that pay-per-view or for that podcast episode. So that's just a vocal minority, and we really hate those people, actually, the vocal minority.
Tim B is going to keep listening. Let's be honest. Him and his friend Mark are going to keep listening.
Those people are going to complain week in and week out, but I know that those same people are going to be the same people who are going to be glued to the TV set next week. Mm-hmm. Anyway, thanks, Tim B.
A more of a sticker than a super chat here, but we got a super sticker from Urka, sending us good vibes. So,
okay. Anything else?
I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk briefly about the Toronto show.
Yeah,
the Toronto shows. So we talked about live touring before.
The AEW Toronto shows or the WWE Toronto?
All of them. So,
okay.
For starters. One thing I wanted to point out about the AEW Toronto shows is that they're running the Coca-Cola Coliseum, which is the B venue in Toronto. Really, it's like the C venue, if you consider.
I've been to some shows at the Rico Coliseum, or they call it the Coca-Cola Coliseum.
Yeah.
It's where Toronto does house shows. It's where they did the like the Roadblock Network special that I went to in 2016.
Yeah, it's what would you say, like it's like a 10,000 seat arena for hockey or basketball as opposed to like an 18,000 seat arena, yeah. Right?
Right.
It's an AHL stadium, so yeah, so for the minor league hockey. Yeah.
For wrestling, I would think 8,000-9,000 max.
Right, and that's what we seem to be set up for. So, if you were touring in Toronto, you have your two regular options would be, like you said, the Coca-Cola Coliseum or the former Rico Coliseum, or the Scotiabank Arena, the former Air Canada Center, which is where the Raptors and the Maple Leafs play, which is the A arena in town.
Sky Dome.
The Sky Dome would be the A arena, right, in the you know,
I'm using all the old names. The Air Canada. ACC.
Yeah, the Sky. I agree that I think it should always be the Sky Dome. It's an infinitely better name than the Rogers Center. But regardless, they're running. So AEW is running the smaller venue, which they easily sold out for Dynamite. I think are close to sold out for Rampage. I don't know if they're totally sold out for Rampage yet. But there's been a lot of speculation, which is why didn't they run the smaller building? Why didn't they run Scotiabank when they easily could have drawn 14,000 people to Scotiabank, which is what WWE had just drew this Monday. You can see that on the bottom line ticker that we have here.
Why didn't they run a pay-per-view? Why didn't they run?
Sure.
I guess maybe they want to make Double or Nothing a Las Vegas tradition. Maybe they want to make All Out of Chicago tradition. Well, why not Full Gear for Toronto?
Well, I think it behooves them to have their pay-per-views roaming. I can see All Out being a regular tradition in Chicago because of the history that's kind of been established there. Double or Nothing, sure, if you can draw big in Las Vegas every year, do it. But I think you only have four pay-per-views and you have a lot of big markets you can serve with them. But my take here is that they're taping Dynamite and Rampage separately. So, yes, they could have drawn 14,000 people at Scotiabank. But would you have been able to draw 14,000 people on a Wednesday night and a Friday night? I would say no, because they already haven't sold out the Rampage tickets. It's also perhaps more expensive to rent out the Scotiabank Arena two nights in a row, or even one night. I don't know the difference in price, but I assume the Scotiabank is much more expensive than the Coca-Cola Coliseum, which is why WWE often runs the Coca-Cola Coliseum. So when you're looking at...
Well, we don't know. Could they even get into the Scotiabank?
Could they even get into it?
Locked up.
Right. And there was... I know Scotiabank, I think, had an event the week that AEW is running in Toronto. Obviously, they didn't have to run Toronto that week. They could run it at a different time. But to me, the explanation is that the Coca-Cola Coliseum is cheaper. And you're going to end up with the same amount of tickets sold as you would if you were just doing one show at the Scotiabank. You're going to end up with 14,000 tickets sold. It's just going to be spread out over two nights, which is probably better for you if you're thinking about things like per cap and perhaps selling more merchandise on two separate nights instead of just one. And so to me, there's not really that big a difference, especially if you factor in that they perhaps got the Coca-Cola Coliseum for a cheaper price than they would have been able to get the Scotiabank. So it's all about what we're really concerned about here is how much money AEW can make. I think there's a decent amount of logic that can be put forward to why they are running a smaller venue than the Scotiabank.
I think there's something to be said for, let's say they had run a pay-per-view, and let's say they could get access to the Scotiabank. I don't know about the Sky Dome. That's shooting pretty high. But the biggest hockey arena, NBA arena.
A pay-per-view with the Sky Dome, I think, would work.
Maybe. Okay. In any case, maybe it's that, or maybe it's just Scotiabank, and you've got this huge sellout crowd. I think there's something to be said for the value in that as a branding event beyond the immediate return that you get from sales, from ticket sales and merchandise sales and pay-per-view buys or even. But that's, you know, I think AEW has already had moments like that, including, I think, that Arthur Ashe show that they did last year was a huge branding event. There was value in that show to AEW in terms of perception, in terms of public relations, in terms of fan perception, because they put nearly 20,000 people or whatever it was in this tennis stadium in New York City. Maybe Newark and maybe UBS Arena in Kenton, Long Island, right?
On Long Island, Brandon. In Long Island.
In Elmont, as I learned in the research for this episode today. I think those two, to a lesser extent, were branding events for them. maybe United Center. Anyway, I think there's a lot of value that's hard to measure when you do things like that. That may be being missed out here by doing two shows in the venue where W runs their house shows.
Well, Dave's new obsession is optics on television and how big your crowd is in running stadium shows and the kind of benefit that that brings to your product and how WWE has benefited greatly from things like the SummerSlam show, which you can say, okay, they half filled a stadium and it's kind of absurd that they only filled up half of a side and they only could shoot the show from one side because they couldn't show the other side. But at the end of the day, it's a massive stadium and it makes WWE look like this huge successful enterprise. And AEW hasn't necessarily capitalized on that.
And we're about to see next weekend, WWE go to Cardiff and put probably more than, I don't know what the WrestleTick's latest is, but more than 50,000, I believe, maybe more like 60,000 people. In there.
Depends on what you're using. So I actually had a question about that for you, Brandon. So I've seen the last number I saw was 65,000 tickets distributed out for the Cardiff show. Dave in the Observer said that it was roughly 48,000 paid and 18,000 comps. Does that comp number seem like super high to you? How is that compared to WrestleMania shows of similar crowd size? Because almost 20,000 comps seems like a huge number to me.
18 comps?
18,000 comps.
Right. And how many paid?
48,000.
So 18 plus 48 is 66. So 18 out of 66 is 27%. I would think 5 to 10% is normal for any event. To be quick here, yeah, that would be a huge comp rate if that's true. What did I have a thing that, because I just did this report that people can see on WrestleNomics.com about what the WrestleMania attendance was like, and WrestleMania WrestleTix tells us about 65,000 out for each day, and I found, based on various assumptions, looking at WWE's financial reporting, that I think, what do I think for the average attendance across 2 days? I think about 115,000. So that's about 165 plus 65 is 130 minus about 115. That's 15 out of 130. That's about 12%. So yeah.
But some of those are the same. That's two nights. That's some of the same people are getting comped, right?
Yeah. Over two. But I imagine that's 10%, maybe.
Yeah, then that number seemed really high to me. I don't know how, like, again, don't know if it's accurate or not. I would somewhat trust that it relatively is. I don't know who those 18,000 people getting comps are. Are they all business partners? Are they friends and family from Europe? I'd be curious to know. It just seemed like a really high number, and it'll be very interesting to see what they announced that number for that Cardiff show is, because the announced number for the what's the announced number for SummerSlam 92?
Somebody want to Google that real quick? I'm Googling something else. 78,000 or 79,000 something? 72,000? Somewhere in the 70s, I believe, is what they announced at SummerSlam.
Is it? WWE's announced number is 80,355. So my guess would be that they're going to announce a bigger figure than that.
I want to say Nikon, I'm looking at the transcript right now. I want to say Nikon made a comment about how many tickets were sold. Yes. He said over 45,000 tickets have been sold for that event. Is that what Dave is maybe deducing there? Just based on Nikon's comment that 45,000, this is the earnings call on August 16th,
Dave,
I believe.
Dave didn't have, he definitely had 48,000 in the, or maybe it was 49,000. It was almost 50,000. It wasn't 45 in the Observer. I don't remember the exact number, so I don't know that specifically. But
on August 16th, right? I think that's the day that W did their earnings mm-hmm. call. That makes sense. Yeah.
And WrestleTix had it at 65,000 fans. And if you remember, this is at a very atypical kind of pattern, right? Where the tickets for the show were originally very disappointing. Because they were extremely high, and I believe they've really cut prices as you've gotten closer to the state. They've moved a lot more tickets, I think, because of that. I remember the tickets were extremely high, like much higher than WrestleMania ticket prices. And so the gate, I'm sure, is going to be enormous for this show. even by, you know, WWE stadium show standards. And the pattern of buying these tickets has been very atypical, I think, than a lot of shows that they do have.
I would be interested to ask somebody who knows how dynamic pricing has changed. It seems like the prices are throughout the ticketing industry, throughout the live events industry, that there's a lot prices for events are changing. Comes to mind too. I was just looking at All Out tickets, which have gone to, you couldn't buy any more single tickets for just All Out anymore. They've changed that. Now you can. They wanted you to buy all three nights in Chicago or in Hoffman Estates. I was looking at the ticket prices. The cheapest ticket on Ticketmaster this morning for All Out is $80, which is pretty high, right? And I was thinking, well, like, what's their average ticket price? Maybe it's like $125 off of like 9,000 or something like that. That would be pricing it for a $1 million gate in a whatever that they hold their 9,000 for that venue for the pay-per-view. So that makes sense if that's what they're pricing it at, to get another $1 million gate for a pay-per-view. What are you smiling about, Gull?
There's something going on in the chat. So I did lean back for a second to stretch out my legs because Brandon knows me. I have very nervous energy. I have to pace and always move my legs and keep the blood flowing. And now it's speculating that I'm just laying back and not doing any hard work and letting you guys do the heavy lifting in the chat. We do have another super chat if you want to talk about that. I don't know if this is the Primo Cologne, but Primo Cologne asks us, there seems to be some growth in the P50 Plus demo for Dynamite in the last 2 months. That's above the average 0.38, with the 18 to 49 down a bit. Has the older demo been what's keeping them above 900,000?
I'm going to put a spread or put a chart into the slide that we can look at. It's relevant to that. That does look like a positive trend there in the last at least 3 weeks, right? Where it's a little bit higher, a little bit higher, a little bit higher. We're looking at P50 plus here. Is that what was the specific question? Is that what's keeping it above 900,000? I would have to do the math. It could be. To the extent that that matters, which I think it matters somewhat, we're talking about whatever age the viewer is, that viewer is attached to a paying sub for cable, which is supporting TNT and TBS, which are driven more so by subscriber fees than they are ad revenue, as opposed to Discovery's incumbent networks. I would have to do the math, which would mean I would have to like bust out the universe estimate. If you have any thoughts about that, I'll try to do that quickly.
Unless Primo Cologne relocated to the UK, I don't think that's him.
So
he's suddenly using the pound. Pound $9 pound sterling, as he would say.
Well, maybe he just feels like giving us some Great Britain pounds. AEW Dynamite P50 Plus did about 525,000 viewers over the age of 50 or older, which was what in the weeks prior? I don't know. See, this was, I would have to do some math, and it was probably more people for a while. I'll tweet it later, maybe. But I do have to get on a plane in a minute, but yeah. I would think if it's just over, I mean, they did hit a million. What did they do in the weeks before that, though? Let's see here. How are we doing in the minute by minutes? Are people tuning out as I'm thinking and doing math here?
No, we have stuck at a standard 59 for a while.
Okay. So 957,000 was the total viewership the week before this one. It might be, yeah. I mean, especially if you go back to August 3rd, where they only had 938. And that is roughly where the P50 Plus starts to increase. But as far as we can tell, AEW still says that they care about, I mean, as of, let's say Tony Khan mentioned the demo issue in a press conference or an interview recently and said something to the effect of the networks tell them that they should focus on some other demo. They'll focus on some other demo. But again, in the overall TV economy, I think any viewer does matter somewhat, but the demo or the younger audience are a signal of, you know, they're telling you where TV's gonna go. So I think it is more important than the older audience, and it's definitely more valuable in immediate terms in terms of ad value. Anything else?
That's all we got here.
I'm not getting on WWE's private jet. That's only for Johnny Gargano, I've heard.
The private jet was chartered by somebody with the last name Khan.
Was it? No. I'm flying Delta. So I have to go to New York to participate in an interview for a documentary. So I'll be back, though, by Wednesday. Maybe we'll do another special bonus audio, maybe. And maybe I'll go to Chicago if I don't decide that I hate travel by the middle of the week. We'll see. Anything to plug?
Jesse, why don't you plug away?
I haven't really done anything over recently. Last week on my podcast, Gentlemen's Wrestling podcast on YouTube, I had Joe Lanza from the Flagship podcast. We did it's getting rave reviews. It's actually our most listened to episode. We talked a lot about Paul Heyman and kind of the legacy of Paul Heyman and kind of comparing and contrasting his, you know, 90s ECW innovative ways days with the more recent history of him kind of becoming this manager of top stars and how he's kind of insulated and secured himself in WWE after years of getting fired and never really understanding how to play ball in that company. So that's people can find that on YouTube. It's Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast. Everything else, just follow me on Twitter at Jesse Collings, at JesseCollings. I know because not all listeners are watching the video and staring at my name for the entire time. So for all our audio listeners, that's how you can find me. Yes.
Golo.
Yeah. Rediscovering the Indies. We'll have a new episode out this week. We'll be talking about a protege of Paul Heyman, Gabe Sapolsky, with our part two in our Dragon Gate USA. And we cover the formation in the first episode. On our first episode. This part, we're going to obviously talk about the company's history and kind of when Evolve gets into the picture and all that and what happens to Dragon Gate USA. So that'll be on Rediscovery Indies this week. Check me out, Chris Gullo, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and get your Bowtie Mafia t-shirts on Pro Wrestling Tees.
Yes. Please hit the thumbs up button. Like, share, and subscribe this on YouTube, on your favorite podcast app. Give us a nice rating if you liked the podcast today. There's always patreon.com/WrestleNomics, which is how you can best support WrestleNomics. And you can get access to the TV ratings reports that I write nearly every day. You get access to the WrestleNomics viewership spreadsheet, which is where some of the data that we were looking at today came from. You get access to all the slides for our podcasts, including this one. These slides right here that we're looking at on YouTube. You get access to the Pro Wrestling Industry Reports for 2019, 2020, 2021, and any additional reporting and analysis that I do. Bless you back there.
That was my wife. I can't believe you can hear that far away. She's in a whole nother room.
Okay. Thanks, everybody, for listening, for tuning in, supporting. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.